Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. In 1980, the small North Texas suburb of Wylie had a population of about 3,700 people. Three of those people would wake the sleepy town, and on a day that typically spells bad luck, Friday the 13th. A love triangle that would result in the death of Betty Gore and a claim of self-defense by her husband's former lover. The brutality and senselessness of the murder left the community with more questions than answers. Okay, on to the show. Candy Montgomery was a bored housewife. After moving to Wylie in 1977 with her husband Pat and two small children, she needed something more. She was active in her church, the Methodist Church of Lucas, but that wasn't exactly what she was missing. You see, they settled on Wylie to remove themselves from the hustle and bustle that comes with living in Dallas, even in the 1970s. Pat was employed with Texas Instruments, and Candy was finally able to have the lifestyle she wanted. Pat's position came with a handsome salary. She married Pat out of convenience. He wasn't strikingly handsome, but he was good enough. Through the church, she met Betty and Alan Gore. They struck up a friendship fast. Alan was more active in church than Betty was. She had been dealing with postpartum depression and had retreated into herself after the birth of their first child. Alan was the opposite. At times, he was very outgoing. He sang in the church choir and assisted in sports activities for the children. But at times, he could also be aloof, which gave off the air that he was pretentious. Candy had slyly expressed to friends that she was interested in having an affair. Not with anyone in particular, but she needed fireworks in her life, something Pat was unable to produce. It was 1978, and Candy and Alan were playing volleyball at the church. They attempted to go for the ball at the same time and ended up bumping into each other. Immediately, Candy noticed his scent. He just smelled sexy to her. He wasn't strikingly attractive, but she wondered if he could bring the spark she desperately wanted. She felt attractive enough. Hell, she had just had two kids. She looked great. And believed that Alan would be a willing participant in the affair. How could he not? He had a somber wife at home, so surely he was just as bored with his spouse as she was with hers. She confessed her attraction and the need to want to act on it one night after choir practice. Boldly, Candy asked Alan if he would like to have an affair with her. There was no sugarcoating, no sweet batting of the lashes, just a straightforward request. At this point, Betty and Alan had been married for 8 years. Betty was a teacher by trade. She loved enriching young minds, but couldn't stand those who misbehaved. She was a beautiful woman who paired oddly with Alan. He had a receding hairline and the beginning of a beer belly. She hated when he traveled because she hated being left alone. She enjoyed her husband's company. Their sex life by this point was non-existent. Betty had only agreed to sex if it was during a time that she was fertile. She was trying for her second child. But after their first child was born, Alan was no longer attracted to her sexually. Sure, he loved her, but that was different. He gave Candy's somewhat unconventional proposal a thought. Betty had stepped outside of her marriage to Alan before, and that hurt him deeply. He wasn't sure he would be able to commit the same offense that caused him so much pain. He knew if Betty ever found out, she would be heartbroken. Despite initially turning down the affair, Alan kissed Candy one night after choir practice. It would be Candy's 29th birthday when she finally received a phone call from Alan. He invited her up to join him for lunch in a neighboring town. This is what she was waiting for. She knew he had reservations about having an affair, but this was a step in the right direction. She wasn't looking for a relationship. She had that. She just wanted passionate sex. Alan and Candy handled the beginning of their affair like a business transaction. They agreed not to get emotionally involved and agreed to meet periodically to hash out the details. They began an emotional affair despite agreeing not to involve emotions. Candy and Alan would spend Alan's lunch breaks just talking and sharing stories. One day, she decided some action needed to happen. She was no longer interested in drafting a pseudo-contract of their affair. She was ready to just do it. They hashed out the final rules. They are as follows. If either one wanted to end the affair, for whatever reason, it would end. No questions asked. If either one became too emotionally involved, the affair would end. If they ever started taking risks that shouldn't be taken, the affair would end. All expenses, food, motel room, gasoline, would be shared equally. They would meet only on weekdays while their spouses were at work. They would meet on a Tuesday or a Thursday, once every 2 weeks. The date their affair began was set in stone, December 12, 1978. She got them a room at the Como Motel. It's only a few miles down the road from where Alan was working in Richardson. I've passed this motel several times on my way from Richardson to Plano. It's a cute, retro-looking motel that sits off of Central Expressway. In researching this case, I will never see the Como Motel the same way again. They consummated their affair, and despite being married for over 8 years, Alan was inexperienced, and Candy could tell. Alan was ecstatic to have someone as vivacious and responsive as Candy in bed. She moved in ways he never knew were possible. He quickly learned what Candy liked, and even found new likes of his own. It was Candy who began to question if the affair was worth it. She had expressed how she wanted sparks to fly, but with Alan, it was as good as it was going to get. She was also beginning to think that she was starting to develop feelings for him. This is a violation of the rules. They discussed her concern, but convinced one another that the affair had not yet run its course, and to give it more time. In July of 1979, Betty and Alan's second daughter was born. He spent most of the month at home, and he felt himself growing closer and more fond of Betty. The affair with Candy had cooled while he spent time with his family. As the month progressed, Alan would eventually return to her. A feeling of guilt washed over him, and he was actually sad for Betty. She was staying home all day taking care of their two children, while he carried on an affair. After a day with Candy, Alan returned home, exhausted. But he was in for a surprise. Betty was insistent that they make love. She had never been the one to initiate lovemaking, and for Alan, he was dead tired. There was no way he could perform. And so he rejected her advances, telling her that he just wasn't in the mood for it. She felt shunned and betrayed by her husband's refusal to make love to her. The next day, he was supposed to meet with Candy, but Betty urged him to stay home so they could discuss what happened the night before. Candy was none too pleased with him missing another one of their meetups and felt scorned. Alan finally spoke with her and confessed that he may have developed feelings for her, which in turn may have caused him to lose feelings for Betty. He didn't want that to happen, and it wasn't part of the deal. Slowly, their affair began to unravel, and Candy told Alan that she didn't know how she could live without him. She loved him. Alan and Betty would attend something called Marriage Encounter. Previously against the idea, Betty agreed to it when she felt that her marriage was slipping out of her hands. According to its website, Worldwide Marriage Encounter is the largest pro-marriage movement in the world and promotes a weekend experience for couples who want to make their good marriage even better. The weekend they spent sharing openly about their shortcomings and their aspirations brought them closer together. Despite the call for total and complete honesty, Alan left out the fact that he was carrying on an affair with Candy Montgomery. After the marriage encounter, Alan wanted to invest all of his time and energy into his family. He didn't want to be distracted by Candy. Candy was catching on, and she made the decision for them. She told him that she would no longer seek him out and that the affair was now over. Candy, seeing how the marriage encounter experience worked for Alan and Betty, wanted to try it out with her husband, Pat. Their weekend did not bring them closer together. The voice in Candy's head was telling her that the affair with Alan was over. For now. It was Friday, June 13th, 1980. Alan was in Minnesota traveling for business. Candy was busy at the church. The children were in vacation Bible school. Betty's eldest daughter had spent the night at Candy's house and was at the church getting ready for a puppet show. Candy tried to call Betty to see if her daughter could spend the night since they were going to see a late show of The Empire Strikes Back at the drive-in theater. She didn't receive an answer. She had to run errands anyways, so she decided to stop by Betty's house and get permission from her in person. She arrived to 410 Dogwood Drive around 10 a.m. and knocked on the door. Betty answered the door and looked more alert than usual, and annoyed. She had been on several pain medications due to ailments that were brought on by stress. Stress that was brought on by her husband traveling for business. What happens next is up for speculation, but here is Candy's account. Candy walked inside and began to ask about Betty's daughter spending the night and offering to take her to her swim lesson in the morning. Betty was fine with that arrangement, but then sat down after some small chit-chat. She calmly looked at Candy and asked, "Candy, are you having an affair with Alan?" Quickly, she said no. But this caused Betty's suspicion to rise. She said, "But you did, didn't you?" Candy was nervous at this point and said, "Yes, but it was a long time ago. Did Alan tell you?" After Candy made her statement, Betty got up and told her that she needed to wait a minute. She walked into the utility room and within a few seconds appeared with an axe in her hand. Betty demanded that Candy never see her husband again, but then she rested the axe against the wall and, oddly, proceeded to tell Candy to grab the swimsuit off the washer. As she was placing the swimsuit in her handbag, she saw the pain in Betty's eyes. Trying to console her, Candy reached across and placed a hand on Betty's arm. Betty suddenly saw red and pushed Candy into the utility closet. She was taken aback by this and pleaded with Betty to stop. By now, Betty had grabbed the axe and demanded again that Candy stay away from Alan. She believed that she was pregnant, and she was not going to have her husband stolen from her again. Candy tried to reason with her, but Betty was having none of it. They grappled for the axe, and Candy was hit on the head. She lifted to swing the axe again, but it missed Candy, just gashing her toe. They continued to fight for it, and Betty began kicking and jabbing the axe into Candy. Betty bit at her hands, and Candy pushed her back as she reacted to the pain. The push knocked Betty off balance and caused her to slip, losing grip of the axe. Candy gained control and made the first blow on the back of Betty's head. Betty reacted to the blow by trying to regain her balance and struggled to get back on her feet. Blood was now gushing from her head and neck. Candy made the decision to run, and as she opened the door, Betty had somehow made her way to the door and blocked her. She saw the axe in Betty's hand again. A second fight began. Blood was beginning to pool on the linoleum floor. It was slippery, and she pleaded with Betty to just let her go. She did not want Alan. She just wanted to leave. Betty looked at Candy eerily and said, "Shh." The axe was now between them, and the handle was bloodied from the struggle. She was done. She was tired. And more importantly, she was angry. Angry that Betty had now essentially ruined her life because of her reaction. She had no more empathy for this woman. She wanted this to be done. So she hacked Betty 41 times and stopped only when she could no longer raise the axe above her head. She panicked and went into the shower fully clothed, trying to wash off the brain matter and blood that had made it onto her clothing. She ignored the cries of Betty's youngest daughter, who was in her room taking a nap, and awoke due to the commotion. She ignored the dogs that were barking outside. She walked out coolly to her car and drove home. She claimed to be in a daze and does not remember how she made it home. All she knows is that she did. She came home and immediately removed her clothing. She threw the bloody clothes into the washer and attempted to find clothing that was similar to what she was wearing previously. She bandaged her cut toe and noticed a small gash near her hairline. She returned to the church and resumed vacation Bible school activities. She had run into a friend, Barbara, in the parking lot, who was expecting her earlier to help with the puppet show. She quickly told her that she had gone to Betty's to pick up a swimsuit, and they lost themselves in conversation. She left and made her way to the Target in Plano before she realized her watch had stopped working. She realized she was late, so she turned back around and went back to the church. She began to walk towards the classroom, and the throbbing of her cut toe made her walk with a slight limp. So she was conscious of this and attempted to straighten up.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor.
The activities ended for the school, and together, her and the children went to the movies. During the day and throughout the night, Alan Gore had attempted to reach his wife. He was growing concerned. This was not like her. She was scared to be home alone, and she typically answered the phone to speak to her husband. His voice helped calm her nerves. Alan called Richard Parker. He was the man who sold them the house and was a next-door neighbor. He agreed to go check on Betty, but got no answer. He called Alan back and informed him of such, and Alan called Candy next. He asked if she had seen Betty that day, and she said she had. She saw her that morning, and that everything seemed to be okay with her. He went to dinner with his co-workers, but couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong. It was now 10 p.m. by the time he returned to his room. He tried the house again, and still got no answer. He didn't know that his wife wasn't answering because she had been dead for hours and their daughter was still crying as the house grew darker by the hour. He reached out to Richard again and asked him to check on the house one more time. Richard reported that the house had lights on and that there were two cars in the garage. He said something is wrong. No one is answering, but everything is on. Alan gave him permission to get into the house however he could. Alan knew he was inconveniencing Richard, so he called upon neighbors Jerry McMahon and Lester Gaylor. They both lived across the street or the alley from him. The three men tried to enter through the house, but were unsuccessful in all of their attempts. Finally, someone suggested that they try the front windows. Richard had realtor keys, and as he approached the front door, he found that it opened with a slight push. They walked in and flipped on the lights. It was quiet by now, but Lester walked in first and flipped on the light switch. The men walked around cautiously, calling Betty's name with no answer. Jerry had peered into the bathroom and saw the bloody scene. He told them quickly, "Something is wrong." They made their way to another bedroom and turned on the light. The frightened young daughter of Betty and Alan Gore was now covered in her own excrement and crying. Richard quickly scooped her up and said he would take her to his house and call the police. The men continued to survey the home and finally made their way to the utility room. As Lester opened up the door, he saw a gruesome and bloody scene. He slammed the door shut and cautioned Jerry not to look because she was dead. Jerry peeked his head in and closed the door quickly and said, "She's blown her head off." Forgetting that Richard was going to call the police, Jerry made his way to the telephone. As he reached for the receiver, the line rang. It was Alan. He couldn't wait any longer. What did they find? Jerry shared what they had found, and that they would stick around for the police. But not to worry. The little one was okay. By the time he hung up the phone, he was in complete disbelief and shock. He had just seen his wife that morning. She was not happy that he was leaving, but he was able to reassure her and somehow managed to get a smile from her. a smile, a genuine smile, something he hadn't seen in months. Now, he would never see that smile again. Police had a suspect in mind from day one, the last person who admitted seeing Betty alive on June 13th, Candy Montgomery. She was brought in for questioning, but denied harming Betty. She stated that she went over for a swimsuit, chatted for a bit, went to Target, and then to the church. She didn't know anything was wrong until Alan called her that evening. Alan returned to Wiley the following morning and was also questioned. He was questioned about his relationship with Betty. He admitted that it had been strained in the past, but that they were working on mending their feelings for each other. Detectives asked if she was having an affair. Alan stated that she was not, to his knowledge. Then he was asked if he ever had an affair. Alan admitted to an affair with none other than Candy. Candy was brought back in for questioning. As the crime scene evidence was being processed, they found a bloody thumbprint on the freezer door. And so they fingerprinted her upon entering the police station. She was questioned about her marriage to Pat, and she stated that the marriage was fine, confused by the line of questioning. She then was asked about extramarital affairs, in which she admitted to having a relationship with Alan. She was further questioned about how the affair ended. She continued to deny any wrongdoing in the axe laying of Betty Gore. The Montgomerys retained defense attorney Don Crowder. They had met him through church. To her defense team, Candy was bottling up a lot of feelings. Don exclaimed that she was not acting like a basket case, which any reasonable person would be if they were falsely accused of such a brutal murder. Don called Candy to his office and told her to tell him the truth about who killed Betty. She admitted to him that she had been the one that committed the murder. She had tried to deny it in her mind, but once the fingerprint evidence confirmed that it was her thumbprint, she finally came to terms with it. Suddenly, the news media swarmed the small town of Wiley. Candy was brought into the sheriff's station to turn herself into authorities on the charge of murder. Her court date was scheduled for October 1980. Prior to her court date, she was placed under hypnosis by Dr. Fred Fazen, a Houston-based psychiatrist. Through hypnosis, he was able to reveal a suppressed memory of Candy's. She was 6 years old and had stepped on some broken glass, resulting in a large gash on her foot. She was brought to the doctor for stitches and was screaming and crying from the pain. Candy's mother covered her mouth and said, "Shh." Later during the trial, Fazen would testify that when Betty Gore shushed Candy 25 years later, it brought back a flood of repressed memories that touched off a violent dissociative reaction. He described that phenomenon as a form of neurosis that can prompt out-of-body experiences. Sufferers sometimes do things without knowing it during bouts of amnesia, sleepwalking, or dream states. Thus, Candy was not responsible for the murder, as she was not mentally present after hearing, "Shh," come from Betty. The prosecution would claim that Candy was jealous and angry over the affair ending. She knew Alan wanted the affair to end because Betty was sucking him back in. The day she arrived to the house, she was plotting to kill her. To finally have Alan to herself, Betty needed to be out of the picture. The defense countered by offering Candy's own testimony of the events to support a case of self-defense. The trial was tense, and people from all over the Metroplex filled the Collin County Courthouse in McKinney. Media followed everyone involved in the trial, attempting to get statements from them. The fact that the murder took place on Friday the 13th brought even more sensationalism to the case. Prosecutors claimed that Candy could have just left. She dealt 41 blows too many to Betty for it to be considered self-defense. They also asked why she didn't call for help. And why did she dispose of evidence? Most importantly, why did this woman who prided herself on being a good mother and a good Christian leave a one-year-old child alone in a house with her mother's dead body? The prosecution rested, asking the jury to find her guilty of murder. Her defense team urged the jury to look past the sensationalism and look at the facts of the case. Look at the self-defense. Look at the struggle that Candy had to put up to protect her life. They stated that the prosecution offered no clear motive. They flipped back and forth with their claims of jealousy and then spontaneous rage. And on October 29th, 1980, the case was then turned over to the jury of 9 women and 3 men. Within 5 hours, they had a verdict. Not guilty. Candy Montgomery was a free woman. She and Pat left the courthouse to jeers of scorn, calling her a murderer, and some residents saying she was now free to sleep with other women's husbands and possibly kill them. The Montgomerys quickly packed up their home and retreated to Georgia. Surprisingly, just a few months after Candy's acquittal, Alan began a relationship with Elaine Clift, who was a neighbor at the time. After their mother's death, the girls did not have a good relationship with their father and were adopted by Betty's parents and moved to Kansas. In 1999, Don Crowder committed suicide after a bout of depression. He shot himself in his home gym while his wife Sherry tried to convince him not to do it. He asked God to forgive him and pulled the trigger. Today, Candy Montgomery is now Candace Wheeler and working as a therapist alongside her daughter with at-risk youth. Her and Pat eventually divorced. Alan and Elaine have divorced. He married a woman named Lindy. He eventually repaired his relationship with his 2 adult daughters. Both of his daughters are now married with children. I have not given their name throughout this episode, out of respect for them and their family, but they did speak to the Dallas Morning News on the 20th anniversary of their mother's passing. The youngest daughter stated, "I just wish I knew what really happened, because nobody knows but her. I just think she got away with it." Candy has refused any interviews that have to do with the death of Betty Gore, or in her words, "I'm telling you, in big bold letters, I'm not interested." A TV movie starring Barbara Hershey called A Killing in a Small Town was released in 1990. You can find a version of it on YouTube. A book was published in 1984 by John Bloom and Jim Alkelson called Evidence of Love, A True Story of Passion and Death in the Suburbs. I'm interested to hear your thoughts. Do you think that it was an act of self-defense? Or did Candy get away with murder? You tell me. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes. It really does help us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast, and of course, on Instagram. Our website is truecrimefanclub.com. If you have an episode request or a general suggestion, send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. I would like to thank the most recent Patreon supporter, Shannon H. Welcome to the club, and thank you so much for your patronage. I hope you continue enjoying the show. Our music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Their work will be featured in all of our episodes, so check them out on Twitter, at We Talk of Dreams. I recently started a Facebook discussion group where we can discuss the cases more in depth. Just search for True Crime Fan Club Discussion Group, and one of our lovely mods will add you. If you aren't following us on social media, then you most likely have missed the contest announcement. As a fan club member, you have earned the opportunity to come up with the ending tagline of the show. As you all know, I typically say, "Until next time," and that is so boring. Now, you get an opportunity to become a piece of the show. You will need to submit your tagline to tcfcpod@gmail.com. Only one entry per person. The prizes include a $25 Amazon gift card, TCFC official member mug, a magnet, and a sticker. Oh yeah, you get a shout out on the show. I started accepting entries on the 24th of April, but the contest runs until the 24th of May. Your entry should be submitted in the following format: name, contact info, don't forget the shipping information, and tagline. The winner will be announced on May 25th. Good luck. While you're waiting for the next episode, check out some of my pod friends' shows. Remember, This kind of horror doesn't just happen in the movies. Sleep well, true crime fans.
Hi, this is Christy Lee of the Canadian True Crime Podcast. Join me for a journey through many of the most heinous and shocking crimes in recent Canadian history, starting with Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka. You can find me on your favourite podcast app, Facebook or Twitter. Just search for Canadian True Crime.
Hi, I'm Cambo from True Crime Island, another true crime podcast. Every 2 weeks, I'll bring you true crime stories from all over the world. Go to my website, truecrimeisland.com, where you can download or stream each episode or search for me on iTunes or your favourite podcatcher. So grab a beer and pull up a deck chair and listen to True Crime Island.
Hi, this is Allison Horrocks, host of the Strange and Unusual podcast. If you enjoy dark history, legends, folklore, murder mysteries, superstition, ghost stories, and more, then this is the podcast for you. On the Strange and Unusual podcast, we explore the fear of the unknown throughout history and how today we still feel the shadowy presence of our ancestors' struggles to explain the unknown. Through current-day pulp culture, urban legends, rituals, and even murder, we are still just fighting to keep our monsters in the dark. You can find the Strange and Unusual podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and more. Visit thestrangeandunusualpodcast.com for links to the show.